This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
How big money invaded sports. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koshenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Here's a book for your summer reading list. It's called Players, the Story of Sports and Money, and it shows how golf opened the door to giant salaries for all pro athletes.
On the health front, why recovering from heart surgery is surprisingly difficult.
A new way to commute to work, combining the technology of drones with self-driving cars so you can fly to the office.
And what are baseball managers even doing these days?
Decades ago, managers really were in charge of everything. They decided the lineup. They decided how much people pitched, who played for a long time. And that's really changed for a lot of reasons. Managers have really gone from dictators to more of middle managers.
Wall Street Journal reporter Jared Diamond on why managers have dropped a rung or two on the food chain. He's here later in the hour. Would you like to read about sports and business? Well, here's one for your summer reading list. It's called Players, the Story of Sports and Money and the Visionaries Who Fought to Create a Revolution. And it's by Wall Street Journal sports writer Matthew Futterman, who looks at the moment when athletes and their handlers took power. Matt, take us through this.
So I really wanted to answer the question of sort of how did we get here? How did sports go in the span of not really very many years, maybe about 40 years or so, from basically what was a mom-and-pop operation to this $150 billion behemoth that is just completely ubiquitous? And the more I looked, the more it came back to this guy named Mark McCormick, who eventually founded the sports and entertainment conglomerate IMG, but in 1959 was a Cleveland lawyer who was kind of bored at his job and was a really good golfer and knew some people in the golf world and started to sign up golfers so he could book them at exhibitions. And one of those golfers was Arnold Palmer, who eventually became basically his only client for a little while. And, you know, together they turned Palmer into the first sort of modern sports entrepreneur.
But it wasn't easy, right? And Palmer was, I don't know, he, at least from the excerpt, seemed like a fairly simple guy who just wanted to play golf.
Yeah, it was not easy at all, especially because Palmer, unbeknownst to him, had essentially signed away his prime earning years to the Wilson Sporting Goods Company. You know, this was back in 1957 when, you know, guys like Palmer, they didn't hire lawyers, they didn't hire agents. Palmer had his wife, Winnie, opening his mail and answering the phone and handling the business side of his life. And he didn't realize that Wilson slipped a provision into what was already an incredibly exploitative contract that allowed them to renew his contract essentially, you know, right through the prime earning years of his life and his career, or what they thought would be the prime earning years of his career through 1964. And when McCormick comes on the scene in 1960, he thinks he sort of struck gold because Palmer has won the Masters in the U.S. Open. And then he reads the Wilson contract and realizes that his client's tied up. And they try to renegotiate a long-term deal. Palmer sort of wanted to negotiate a 20-year deal that would have raised his salary from Wilson from about $7,000 or about $10,000 at that point, because he was earning some bonuses, to about $100,000 a year. And the talks eventually broke down because Wilson refused to buy Palmer a $800 life insurance policy. And when they didn't do that, he eventually was sort of forced to start the Arnold Palmer Golf Company. And it went in about 5 years from making $10,000 a year to making about $500,000 a year off his name.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal sports writer Matthew Futterman. He's got a new book called Players, and it's about the moment when athletes and their handlers took power. And it's a look back at Arnold Palmer and his initial handler named Mark McCormick. I was fascinated by some numbers you put together, too. when you were describing how sports took off also in the 70s, and you said, you know, kind of how we went from Roger Staubach to Tony Romo in the football world. What were some of the numbers you used, like, from getting from Staubach to Romo?
Right. Well, what's important to understand, like, in this, you know, in this book, you know, McCormick and Palmer are sort of the starting point, but it goes from there. And what they created in golf was sort of copied and acted upon in all the other sports. It sort of spread like a democracy movement. One of the last places it spread to was football. And, you know, to get an idea of how far behind football was, Roger Staubach was the starting quarterback of the Cowboys in 1971, and he was making $25,000 a year for that job. At that time, my dad was a government lawyer in the State Department, and he was making $25,000 a year. Today, Tony Romo plays under a contract for worth $120 million, and that State Department lawyer makes about $80,000. So what you have is this sort of complete transformation in the last 40 years of how money still has filtered its way through sports and where that money goes.
What jumped out at you the most as you were putting this together? What shocked you?
You know, really, it was stunning to me how small, how sort of small and bare bones everything was really recently. You know, the NFL, you get back and you talk more about the NFL here. You know, the NFL really sort of completely changed its rules in the late 70s because they realized that their game was sort of turning into a dud.
Matthew Futterman from the Wall Street Journal. Again, the book is called Players, The Story of Sports and Money and the Visionaries Who Fought to Create a Revolution. 12 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Looking for the next place to grow or expand your business? Why not look to a state that's a top 10 pro-business state, where 2,000 unnecessary regulations were eliminated over the past 5 years, and is now home to the sixth best entrepreneurial climate? All this and more awaits you in the state of Michigan, the state that should be the number one choice for your business. Go to michiganbusiness.org to learn more. As heart patients survive ever more complex surgeries, they are often surprised by how tough it can be to bounce back after the operation, especially on a particular organ. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
While recovery can be tough after any kind of surgery, it's especially hard for those who have had heart surgery. Laura Landro of the Wall Street Journal is here with the story. Laura, why is cardiac surgery so tough to go through?
Well, look, obviously, this is the most vital organ you have, and people's chests are being cracked open, and things are being done that, you know, you could basically can't probably imagine. And I think because of all of the things that happen in the body in response to any kind of trauma, because it's the heart, you know, you've got this natural inflammatory response, and it's dramatically amplified in heart surgery. So that can sometimes do things to other organs and cause your immune system to go a little crazy. So a lot of things can happen. And of course, you're under deep anesthesia. So anesthesia has been shown to, in some patients, cause some sort of post-operative cognitive dysfunction.
Do doctors tell patients about all the things they're facing before going in?
You know, I think a surgeon, surgeons are great, thank God for them, but I don't think that they're focused as much on those kinds of things as they are. I've got to make this operation work. I've got to do this surgery and this procedure. I'm going to save this patient's life, and then I'm going to move on to the next patient whose life I've got to save. So more or less, those kind of after recovery issues are left, you know, into the cardiac rehabilitation, maybe some of the nurses, maybe back to your primary care physician, a cardiologist. But it doesn't. There isn't always, I don't think, full disclosure, and I don't think, frankly, anybody ever focuses on all the things that might happen afterwards. You know, they'll give you a long list. You might hear what they're saying, but forget it 5 minutes later because you're so stressed out about the surgery that they may not tell you as much, and you may not hear what they do tell you.
Is there any way to prepare for this kind of serious surgery, either mentally or physically, before you undergo it?
Well, I think very many studies have shown that the people who, and now obviously this isn't always something that's going to be under your control if you're sick with five different things and you have to have this heart surgery, but, you know, some of the patients we spoke to, one of them, young man, was in incredibly good shape, and they will tell you that going into surgery in very good physical condition, not being a smoker, not drinking to excess, you know, probably not drinking a lot, doing all of the things that are healthy to control your blood pressure, making sure that you're on all the correct medications, you know, having good nutrition. All of those things going into surgery have been shown to, you know, make you a little stronger coming out.
Why do so many people suffer from depression and other problems after cardiac surgery?
You know, that's a really good question, and I think they're not entirely sure. Obviously, there's just that feeling that, my goodness, I'm so vulnerable now. I'll never be able to do the things I once did. You're afraid, like, can you return to normal activity? Some people are afraid to have sex. Some people are afraid to do their usual, you know, pastimes, even, you know, golfing or tennis. So there's, I think, the feeling of vulnerability and mortality, I think, hits you very hard. And, you know, a lot of it is the kind of attitude you have. Some of the research has shown that people who are generally optimistic might do better, while others who aren't might get even worse. But the studies have shown that as much as 40% of patients do suffer from depression after cardiac surgery. And there was a study that came out suggesting that, you know, giving people antidepressants before surgery might help.
We are speaking with Laura Landreau of the Wall Street Journal about heart surgery. Laura, how important is it to get help from others after you've had surgery?
Well, support is huge. You know, people who have support in their families. You know, we talk to people. The one young man had his parents move in with him, an older fellow that we spoke to. His wife just basically stopped working to help him out and do everything, you know, that she could for him. You know, it helps to be to have a strong support network. That's why it's sometimes harder for older people. Maybe they're widows or widowers, and then they have the surgery, and there's not really a strong network around them. Their kids don't live nearby. So that can be hard. I think a surgery study, JAMA Surgery, had a study back in February finding that the patients who were divorced, separated, or widowed actually had a 40% greater chance of dying or developing a new functional disability in the first 2 years following cardiac surgery than the married patients.
Wall Street Journal's Laura Landreau with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka. 20 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Those apps on your smartphone that aim to make your life simpler are also taking advantage of your short attention span. Want to cancel a particular service connected to an app? Good luck. As Alyssa Bereznak at The Ringer reports, there's an intentional and rage-inducing labyrinth to cancellation. Alyssa, what have you found?
It was mostly just all of the apps that I've downloaded on my smartphone that sort of presented themselves as ways to make my life more convenient, either through laundry delivery or prepared meal delivery or any of those things, and sort of examining the cost of those apps, because they're really easy to install, and it's really great when you get a coupon, like discount off on the first way around, but it's actually really, really hard to wring yourselves from them and cancel your subscription.
And that's deliberate, I presume.
Yes, very deliberate. I mean, it's the same thing that, you know, all of these companies like Comcast or Verizon have been doing for years. Like, you can't actually cancel the service online. They make you call someone. That person is really difficult. I'm sure we've all had our fair share of Comcast horror stories. And now it's becoming really common to do the same thing in the app world. And maybe, I mean, I just know that someone like my mother would never stand for being taken advantage of by a company. But as someone who is constantly being bombarded with things on my phone and is just generally apathetic about things in general that are online because it's just too much to handle, I think our generation and sort of a younger sort of smartphone addicted generation is more willing to let these monthly fees incur because it's too inconvenient to cancel.
Mm. Ouch. All right. So did you come across any kind of solution here?
There are a few solutions. Companies like Truebill, you can install it on your bank account and they can identify recurring charges that seem suspicious and help cancel subscriptions for you, or at least identify which ones are happening every single month. You know, I think another thing about this is, and something that the CEO of Truebill mentioned to me, is that we used to be able to get, like, monthly statements of our bank accounts, but now you can check your balance at any time. So there's less of a worry of overdrafting or not being able to keep track of things. But as a result, we sign up for these monthly services not realizing a really huge sum of money that's removed from our balance every month. And I think people probably have, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 more subscriptions than they want. So this service will tell you what you've got going and which ones might be okay with canceling.
We're speaking with Alyssa Bereznak, staff writer at The Ringer. She's got a piece entitled Welcome to the Apathy Economy, and she's really writing here about the difficulty of canceling a service, especially one that's come through an app that you've downloaded. What else is out there?
One of the things that I write about in the piece is that some of these services are things that I don't necessarily need, and when I am sort of screwed over by them, I feel more guilt than I do anything else. Like, I don't feel outrage at the company. I feel, like, just bad about myself that I, you know, signed up for this thing that sends me yoga pants every month as opposed to just going and to the yoga pants store,
right,
you know?
Right.
So I think that might also be a factor in it, though. That could just be my own self-loathing. I think, in general, that a lot of these services don't necessarily solve problems for us. They just save us a certain amount of time. But it's really important to keep sort of a mindful mindset about this so that you don't overdo it with these apps and end up causing your bank account more harm than you would like for this tiny bit of convenience.
Has the Better Business Bureau weighed in on this at all?
They have. I mean, they rated a lot of these apps complete F ratings. Just Fab, which owns the yoga pants company I was talking about, that's sort of headed up by Kate Hudson, of all people, they have a really, really bad rating, and they've gotten a lot of flack for the inconvenient cancellation policy they have. And I think they're actually, because of those ratings, they've decided to allow online cancellation this month. I mean, it's so crazy to even talk about these apps because they're so useless, but there's an app that will give you like a monthly lingerie delivery service called Adore Me, and they got an F from the Better Business Bureau. So I think it's such a new thing, and there's so many of them coming from all different places that they haven't really been able to quantify these services as a whole, but they do really recommend that any business that has a monthly subscription needs to continue checking in with the customer. And they don't think it's enough that simply saying nothing is approval to take money out of your bank account. And I would agree,
right,
but many companies don't.
Alyssa Bereznak at The Ringer, 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. How great would it be if the post office were open 24/7? No more limited hours. You could get your mailing and shipping done on your schedule. Well, now you can when you use Stamps.com. Print postage whenever you need it, right from your desk. Stamps.com will save you the time and hassle of going to the post office. There's no more rushing there during your busy day. Just use your computer and printer to get official U.S. postage for any letter or package. Then the mailman picks it up. It's that easy. You'll save money with Stamps.com, too, by getting exact postage the instant you need it. No more overpaying. You'll even get special postage discounts that you can't get at the post office. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my last name, Deal, for this special offer. A 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Deal. That's Stamps.com and enter Deal. Well, with summer having arrived this week, weather-related disasters, including hurricanes, tornadoes, and wildfires, are more prevalent. Due to their severity, families can't and shouldn't wait to prepare. How ready is your family? We're joined now by Mark McGilvery, Senior VP at Allstate Insurance. Mark, where do we begin?
Well, I think the first step is to have an emergency kit. So it's something everybody can do. It's not that hard to do. Just have something available in the home in case you either have to go to a safe spot within the home, and maybe you've got, as an example, tornadoes coming where you need to kind of be in the basement for a while until it passes. Maybe you end up with power outages for length of time, or if you need to leave the home. So maybe there's an evacuation order. You want to have all the items ready, prepared. You can just grab and go, follow the authorities' direction, and then end up with food, water, prescriptions. Don't forget about the pets, right? All those things that you need if you do have to leave your home in a hurry.
All right, so there's kind of two things, right? Well, I guess a little emergency kit you might have in the home if you mentioned you're stuck there because of a power outage or tornado threat, and then something in case you have to evacuate. Or are they the same kit or what?
I would try to make it the same kit because I do think the kind of items you will need in both cases are the same. So whether you're kind of, let's say, stuck in your home for a period of time or you have to get out of town and you've got to get in the car and move, the kind of things you're going to need are really the same. So I would try to make it one kit, make it easy for everybody. You don't have to prepare two different tubs of stuff.
Got it. I thought it was interesting, too. You point out, at least with regards to insurance, you want to document your stuff, and you say, but just take pictures with the phone.
Absolutely. There not many people actually do this, but with the tools available today, documenting and inventorying the things that you have, and it'll make it so much easier for you if something does happen. So there are great online tools. One of the best, obviously, is the Allstate Digital Locker. It's free. Just download the app. You can then just take the photos, inventory your items, and if something does happen, you are now fully prepared to help yourself begin the recovery process.
We're speaking with Mark McGilvery, Senior VP at Allstate, and we're talking about preparing your family for natural disasters. All right, how about an evacuation plan?
Absolutely. This is something else that you really need to do, both from a standpoint of if there's kind of an individual storm where you've got to get out of the house or a fire in the home, you want to have a game plan, right? How do I get out of the house? How do I get the family out of the house? Where do we meet? Where do we contact each other? If it is a case where you've got to, again, have an evacuation order where the authority's saying we've got a hurricane warning or a tornado warning or wildfires, something that says you're going to have to leave your home, where do we go? How do we stay in contact? Is there maybe out-of-town relatives that everybody would connect with just to make sure it's safe? Have a plan. Practice it. Be prepared in case something does happen and you've got to make quick decisions.
Well, I was looking at this one stat in the notes that you guys sent. AccuWeather says natural disasters have affected 217 million people every year since 1990.
And when you think about all the different weather events that happen across the country, really nobody's immune from this. No matter where you live, there are potential scenarios. And over the last couple of years, we've seen a dramatic increase in some of those severe weather events. So no matter where you live, you've got to start thinking a little bit about how do I prepare if something does happen.
Thanks, Mark. Mark McGilvery, Senior VP at Allstate Insurance. It's 21 minutes now before the hour. It sometimes feels we're inundated with daily reports about self-driving cars. Same for drones, right? But what if the two are combined, allowing us to fly to work Jetson style with a type of personal aircraft? Here's tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of the Enderle Group. Rob, what did you look at?
You know, some of the various car companies that are in the market and creating flying vehicles, like Mueller International, who has two prototype flying cars. And then I also mentioned that there is a viable rocket belt on the that's coming to market as well, called the Martin Jetpack. Unfortunately, it weighs about 500 pounds, and it's not cheap. But at least you can fly for about 10 minutes. And so that, wow, that'd be enough for a short-term commute. So we're getting really close. The at the core of this is the fact that as they solve the problems for drone delivery, they automatically solve the problems for flying cars, because you work through the traffic issues, you work through the safety issues, and all it is a matter of, rather than delivering a package, you're now delivering a person, and you have the same safety concerns, because it's, you don't want a drone falling out of the sky, because it would kill you, and clearly don't want a flying car falling out of the sky, because not only would it kill anybody on the ground, but it would kill the passengers.
Yeah,
the same stuff that we'd need for flying cars is being solved for flying drones.
Jeez. All right. So, what's the realistic nature on this? In other words, all this infrastructure spending that we need in the country for roads and bridges and tunnels, should we just put it on hold so we can all have jetpacks or drones that'll drop us off somewhere?
Well, for the most part, this stuff would be local. Most of the experimental stuff that's being used is electric, and that means you're probably talking about a 15 to 30 mile range, reasonably, most likely 15 for the short term and then 30 long term. So you're still going to need heavy stuff delivered by cars and by trucks. So you'll still need roads for that. So long distance, trucks or trains, short distances for this to take over. But think of this as flying Uber for the most part. You wouldn't necessarily have to or want to buy one.
Oh, okay.
You would just call for an Uber. The Uber would fly and land in front of your house. You get into it and take you where you want to go. The experience would probably be a lot closer to an elevator, except you'd use your cell phone to notify that you wanted the vehicle, and right. then the vehicle would show up when you needed it, and then off you would go to your destination.
Jeez. We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle. He's written a piece called "We Are So Close to Saying Goodbye to Traffic and Flying to Work Instead." How close? I guess anybody, years, a decade,
10 years. So we should have the drones fully sorted and in place well within 5 years. In fact, one of the outfits out of Asia that has a basically it's a flying people carrier. They're starting trials here in the U.S. before the end of the year. So that'll start trials. What's probably going to take the time, though, is getting through the regulatory, getting the batteries right, making sure that there's virtually no risk to getting in these things, and that's probably going to take about a decade. But when I say we're close, you know, when you start talking about starting trials this year, that means we're going to have the vehicles up in the air in a number of areas before the end of the year. Just they'll be in test, and at least 5 years in test. And then from then on, it's a matter of getting the FAA on board and getting everybody happy. But remember, by 5 years, we're going to have these large drones. If you've seen the Amazon drones, they're pretty good size. I mean, they could deliver a microwave oven to you or something along those lines, and probably carry a couple of those items for delivery. And we're just talking about scaling it up maybe by a factor of four to get to people, and size is easy. It's getting them to navigate without crashing into each other, and having them have safety gear on them so if you do get a failure, they don't go falling down on somebody. That's the hard part.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of the Enderle Group. It's 13 minutes now before the hour on This Weekend.
A great business needs a stunning website, and with Wix.com, you can do it all by yourself. Wix.com makes it easy to look amazing online, no matter what type of business you're in. Show off your images in a beautiful gallery, grow your contact list, and get all your social media in one place, just the way you want. Your customers are going to love it. So, what are you waiting for? Show the world what you can do. Go to Wix.com and create your stunning website today. It's easy and free.
The role of today's baseball manager has changed. He's not doing as much as he used to. Not long ago, he controlled all of the in-game strategy and day-to-day decisions like who played and how often. But Wall Street Journal reporter Jared Diamond says thanks to the rise of data-driven decision-making in the front office, field managers have largely transformed into middle managers. Jared, what's going on here?
Well, we look at baseball back in the old days, decades ago, managers really were in charge of everything. They decided the lineup. They decided how much people pitched, who played, when to bunt, when to steal. They pretty much had total control of everything that happened in the games in baseball for a long time, and that's really changed now for a lot of reasons. Managers have really gone from dictators to more of middle managers, where there's a real democracy, where these managers used to be totally in charge, now are pretty much just there to facilitate advice from lots of different people.
All right, and those different people might include underlings, like the players, technically, I guess, versus front office managers, right?
It's both. Like, the front office these days in today's baseball is very, very involved, and a lot of managers, especially older school managers, don't always like that. They see it as meddling, but that's the reality of today's game. With all the data that we now have, all of the research that is in baseball, that's all relatively new, just about a decade or so old. Now all of these executives, a lot of them have fancy degrees, went to Ivy League schools. They are not the ones executing the decisions in the game, but they're supplying so much information to the manager, and they're hiring managers with the expectation that they're going to execute a larger organizational plan. And if the manager isn't willing to get in line with that plan, he won't get hired. And that's why you're seeing today so many newer managers are players that had recently retired, who are barely older than the players they're managing,
yeah,
and have no experience. And they're getting thrust into these jobs because they have so much help from up high.
Does that mean that these young players who have become managers with no prior experience are a bunch of yes men?
Well, some people might say that, but I'm not really sure that what it is exactly. The manager's role in the games on the field is really a job of managing personality. You have a roster of 25 players for 6 months. You're playing every single day, tons of travel. These guys are together more than they're together with their own families. And the manager's job really is, might not be to manage in the games, call bunts, call fields. These things are a bit antiquated. They're not really part of baseball anymore. Instead, their job is to manage the people, make sure that this clubhouse doesn't just explode. And that's a tougher job than it seems. These are young men who are combustible, who are together a lot, and the manager needs to keep everybody in line. You have egos. You have people making a lot of money, and a good manager is one that keeps everyone together through all that. And that's why every player you talk to will say the most important trait for a manager isn't baseball strategizing, but it's communication. It's being able to communicate and keep people sort of happy and in line over a very, very long season.
Since managers these days have become more middle managers, is that the reason, as you point out in the story, that we're seeing kind of this fall off in bunting and base stealing?
It's a big part of it. The rate of bunting is at the lowest point it's ever been in Major League history by a wide margin.
It's Wall Street Journal reporter Jared Diamond. 6 minutes now in front of the hour. Here's a story making the rounds on Facebook. It's about the effort by a father in Kansas to reduce his son's insecurity after a cancer surgery left him with a noticeable scar on the side of his head. Gabriel Marshall, who's 8, was diagnosed with a rare form of brain cancer in March of last year. Surgeries to remove his tumor left him bald and with a scar that kind of resembles the letter C above his ear and extending toward the front of his head. His dad, Josh, decided to get a tattoo mimicking his son's scar. He told his son, if people want to stare at you, then they can stare at both of us. Mr. Marshall's decision has not only boosted his son's confidence, but they also won a competition by the St. Baldrick Foundations called hashtag Best Bald Dad, beating out 55 other entries. ABC News, by the way, says Gabriel is doing well. Though a small portion of the tumor still remains, it has not grown. He receives scans once every 3 months with his next MRI scheduled for next week. That'll do it for this program. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.
In business, risks and rewards come with every decision, like moving to the cloud with Office 365. While its benefits include anywhere access and lower costs, cyber threats and user errors can quickly wipe out data and the money you save. Barracuda Essentials for Office 365 provide an added layer of security and functionality for threat protection, email migration, data recovery, and quality of service. Move securely to Office 365. Visit barracuda.com/essentials to learn more.